Thank you. Bill. Where's Bill? Bill. There you are. Come on up. Don't lolly dolly. Okay, is this working? Okay, it's not working again. Okay. Well, Bill Koenig is head of Koenig News or something like that, right?
Koenig International News.
Yes. And his website, here we go, is watch.org. And he has just tremendous information. He's a White House correspondent. He's been there for 9 or 10 years at the White House. He camps just inside the door there. Just kidding, of course. And he keeps up on, political issues and things, and especially things related to Israel. And you can subscribe for $1 a month.
A week, yeah.
Week, excuse me. To his news service that he sends you on Friday very faithfully. A lot of it I consider inside information about what's going on in Washington and things that we as evangelical believers would be interested to know about and stuff. It's no National Enquirer stuff on his site. And so Bill has been here a number of years, and so he's going to bring us this year's analysis.
Yeah, right there. Okay, good to go. Yeah, I thought I'd put this up. Tommy sent this to us and said we didn't have to use it, but I thought I would. This is a really great artwork. Contending for the Faith. Thanks, Tommy. Full appreciation for the work Tommy does. Well, here's our website, watch.org. This is, for those who aren't familiar with it, this is, we post news 365 days out of the year. And thanks to the internet, we're able to monitor websites from Israel, Russia, throughout the Middle East, European Union, and also the United States media. So there's just so much happening right now. It's helpful to get a perspective from various countries that also have an interest in what's taking place in Israel and the Middle East. As Tommy mentioned, we put out a weekly news report. It's approximately 15 pages. It comes out every Friday by email, and it is becoming extremely difficult to keep it at 15 pages. But it's a weekly summary of all the news, or most of the news, that happened from a biblical and prophetic perspective. And there's just so many things taking place. And I mention this frequently, all major areas in prophecy are in play today. Where we used to have two or three or four at a time, and it was a challenge even then to stay up with that. But I'd say all 12 events, are all 12 key nations, Russia, Iran, Turkey, obviously Israel, the United States, one world financial order, one world political order, one world religious order, everything is in play right now. It's moving at a breathtaking pace, and we have never seen so many complex issues. I mean, these issues have a history of complexity, but nothing like today. And when they're moving as fast as they are, it is literally keeping us extremely busy trying to stay up with it. And thankfully, we have the scriptures that is a great roadmap. And we're blessed to be living in the most exciting time in biblical history. This also is a way to be prepared personally. I'm going to share some things tonight, three areas of interest that I think that we all need to become aware of going into 2013. But this gives us an opportunity to be prepared personally. And we are still a small part of the church that understands fully what's happening in the biblical significance of these days. And also what to pray about. We have a lot of people that are part of Bible studies or groups that come together once a week to pray for Israel. Or through their Bible study, they take this information and it gives them things to pray about, leaders to pray about, issues to pray about. And that's a very important component to our weekly news report. And as Tommy shared, it's $1 a week for an annual subscription and $1.15 a week for a six-month subscription. Also, this is a copy of my book I've shared before, Eye to Eye, Facing the Consequences of Dividing Israel. What do these major record-setting events have in common? The 10 costliest insurance events in U.S. history, now the 12. The 12 costliest hurricanes in U.S. history, 3 of the 4 largest tornado outbreaks in U.S. history, and the 2 largest terrorism events in U.S. history. All took place at the same time or within 24 hours in most cases of U.S. pressure applied on Israel to divide their covenant land. The greater the pressure on Israel, the greater the corresponding catastrophe. 9/11 and Katrina are both examples of enormous events. 9/11, 17 days prior to 9/11, President Bush was working with the King of Saudi Arabia, at that time Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Crown Prince Abdullah, on the two-state solution. And this was something that his father, Bill Clinton, would have never gone to, or worked on. 17 days prior to 9/11. And then Katrina began the day that President Bush congratulated Israel for evacuating or evicting 9,500 Jews from their homes in Israel. I have a DVD here that I brought with this. Is America Under Judgment? It's a one-hour teaching that's very comprehensive on the church, what has taken place with the Obama administration in reference to Israel, also what he has done with the LGBT agenda, the promotion of the same-sex union. I go into great detail in his words, what he has spoken, and shown how America is moving rapidly and, if not, under judgment. I'll go into more details here shortly. And also have an hour-long Middle East review of what is taking place with Israel and the neighborhood, the key nations across the Middle East. Tonight I'm going to focus on three areas that I think that we all have a lot of interest in and what's happened and what's going to transpire. The first one is the U.S. election, what just transpired with the U.S. presidential election in November. The U.S. economy, the things that are coming together, the 14 potential financial contagions that are coming together. And then also what is taking place with Israel and the Middle East and the leaders of the Middle East that we're watching very actively. First of all, the U.S. election surprised a lot of people. I think the fact that millions of Christians were praying around the country, the fact that many Christians were fasting for 40 days, the fact that there was an enormous attempt to get the Christian vote out. You know, Romney had his shortcomings, no doubt, and obviously his Mormon faith was of great concern. But a lot of people were voting for a guy, for the most part, that followed the biblical principles, opposed to a lot of Obama's positions on abortion, same-sex unions, pressure on Israel, etc. So I think a lot of people were surprised by the outcome. I think when you hear Michael Barone, one of the top experts in the country that knows every single congressional precinct in America, who understands, who remembers every election back into the early 1900s in the history, stating that there was a good chance that Romney was going to win, possibly even a landslide. George Will, Dick Morris, Karl Rove, when you hear experts like this that were predicting a close race or even the possibility of running the board, we had 9 swing states. 9 swing states, and Romney only won 1 of the 9. I think a lot of us are surprised. Obama fits the prophetic role. I told people over and over again, Obama fits the prophetic role of the times we're living in, as Ed shared in his message today. He is the perfect leader for the time that we're in, and the nation that we're in, the country that we're in, the times that we're in. I mean, he really fits the mold, but there was some hope that we might have one more opportunity to try to get things into order. Romney had a good, solid business background. Paul Ryan was a really quality guy that understood the fiscal condition of our country. He really understood it. They had, good families. And as Charles Krauthammer said, the Democratic attack machine was looking for skeletons in Romney's closet for months upon months upon months. But they found out that Romney didn't even have a closet. He's a squeaky, clean guy who loved his wife and loved his family. So they, I can tell you what, if there was dirt there, the attack machine of Obama, they would have found something. But nonetheless, that still was not enough. I'll go through some of the statistics from the race to kind of give you a better understanding of the demographic breakdown. Of the, it was 121,745,000 votes that were casted. As we know, Obama won 332 of the electoral votes, Romney 206. The big surprise there, we kept hearing that Romney was going to win some of the swing states, possibly even run the board, that he was going to win Pennsylvania, in Florida, in Ohio, in Colorado, in Wisconsin, Ryan's home state, and possibly Colorado, and maybe even Pennsylvania, if I didn't mention it. So, I mean, the fact he only won one of the nine, North Carolina, was really a shock to a lot of people. And I know there's still a lot of investigation of the vote and how the vote was tabulated and things like that, but once someone receives something, it's hard to take away. Just like Obamacare. Once Obamacare was put in place, it's hard to change Obamacare, the way our legislature is structured, the way our Congress is structured. Once don't ask, don't tell squeaked through, it's hard to take that away. And the same thing with something much bigger, which is a national election. But nonetheless, the outcome, we know what the outcome was. Of the white vote, Romney received 72%. The white vote was 72%. Obama received 39%. And 45% of the male white vote went for Romney. And Obama received 39% of the white vote, 45% of the male vote, and 42% of the female vote. The black vote, 15 million, Obama received 93%. 87% of the male, which is interesting because he received 95% of the male in the 2008 election. And he received 96% of the male, a female, a vote again, which was what he received in 2008. And what's interesting here is there were black pastors that were furious at Obama's same-sex position on marriage. Furious. They attempted to have a meeting with President Obama, and he refused to meet with them. There were black pastors around the United States that said, we, the black community, black Christian community, cannot vote for a president that has the position that he has on abortion and on gay marriage. It was an extraordinary effort by them to make sure that these black Christians would not vote for Obama because of these two positions, these immoral positions. But obviously it didn't have an impact. The Hispanic vote, 10% of the election, Obama received 71%. 65% of male, and 76% of female. The Republican Party walked right into a trap that the Democrats set up. And unfortunately, Sean Hannity, Laura Ingraham, Bill O'Reilly to a certain extent came on really strong on immigration, even to the point that it made the Republican Party look insensitive. And even during the Republican primary, Rick Perry was asked about the education of Hispanic children from undocumented workers. And he was very compassionate about the importance of education for these young people that have been born in America. Well, he took a tremendous amount of heat from the Republican establishment, and that was a turning point for the Hispanic vote that President Bush received as much as 42% in his 2004 election. He was making huge inroads into the Hispanic community, but the Republican Party walked into this trap and were insensitive, and it came across insensitive, and it had a dramatic impact on him not receiving the Hispanic vote in this election. Asians, 3%, and 73% of them voted for Obama. The evangelical Democrats, or demographics,
78% voted for Romney. Obama received 22%. That's 6.8 million born-again evangelicals that voted for Obama. And I can tell you that disappointed greatly a lot of Christian leaders, especially that were attempting to get the vote out in opposition to Obama. The Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life said that 80% of evangelicals voted for Romney. Some polls added at 78, as I mentioned earlier. 95% of the black evangelicals supported Obama, and I mentioned some studies said 93%. The Catholic voters who regularly attend Mass broke 67% for Romney and 32% for Obama. And a lot of that has to do with the incredible contention between the Obama administration and the Catholic Church over offering birth control pills, forcing the Catholic Church to provide birth control as part of the Obamacare for the obligation on church or a Christian or Catholic affiliated organizations or hospitals. Obama also received 69% of the Jewish voters. He received 78% in 2008. It was the Jewish vote is very important. Isn't it interesting? It's about 2% of the vote. About 25% of the money for the Democratic Party comes from the Jewish community. But what's important about the Jewish vote is they are in key electoral states like Florida, New York, Ohio, Michigan. And if 10% of the Jewish people that live in Florida had shifted their vote over to Romney, Romney would have won Florida. It's a very, it's amazing how the Lord's did it. And there was a lot of vying all the way down into the election day of the Republican Party being a better friend of Israel versus the Democrats saying Obama's a better friend of Israel. And you had a lot of the high-profile Democratic members coming out and speaking of all these great things that Obama has done for Israel and talked about the relationships that Israel had, that Obama had with Israel. So it was a real debate all the way to the election. But unfortunately, not enough Jewish voters voted for Romney. And then Obama received 62% of the non-church. 5 million fewer evangelicals voted for Obama in 2012. 4.7 million more evangelicals voted for Romney than voted for McCain. Obama received 42% of the Protestant vote, down from 45%. And Romney received 57% of the Protestant vote, up from the 54% McCain won. So bottom line, Romney was doing better than McCain. He got more voters from the Protestants, from the evangelicals, and from the Catholics. But still, when you look at the Protestant, and a lot of them are wrapped up in the social network or the social justice movement, which is very much heavily involved. A lot of Democrats are very much involved in that movement. It was close to 50-50. 42%. A few off 50-50. But as you can see, again, the evangelicals overwhelmingly voted for Romney because of biblical principles. But again, the Protestants and Catholic were pretty close to par, which had another. I mean, when you have an election, it was about 3 million people and down to some relatively small amounts in some key states. If there have been some shifts by the black believers, by the Hispanic believers, by more Protestants and by more Catholics taking these moral positions more serious, then Romney would have been successful. But he wasn't. And then here's the diagram here. This is, it's really amazing how close the demographics of the 2008 and 2012 election were. So with all the $2 billion spent, all the negative ads, there was very little true shift away from Obama. Isn't that amazing? And I think I was thinking about this right after the election, and the Lord put it in my heart. The 2008 U.S. presidential election, America knew very little about Obama. The Republicans were more informed, but for the most part, we knew very little about him. But the 2012 U.S. presidential election, America knew a lot about Obama. a lot, and we are accountable for his reelection. This is very significant. 2008, very little. 2012, movies, documentaries, advertisements, Trump's efforts, birther efforts, just a tremendous amount of information about Obama. And a lot of people to this day don't know a lot about some of his background, but nonetheless, we knew a lot about him, his positions on abortion, his positions on gay marriage. He was very out front, but America chose him again. America has that responsibility. And America's fully accountable. The U.S. economy in 2013, we're hearing a tremendous about this every single day right now with the fiscal cliff negotiations. And we are literally moving into a very significant time economically. I'm going to share 14 major potential financial contagions. I wrote a couple news reports on this the last 2 weeks. And these are to inform you, give you a better understanding at the same time you feel led, talk to your financial advisor. Meet with them. Discuss these things. Discuss what you already know. Discuss some things I'm going to share tonight and discuss some things that your financial advisor definitely knows about. Any one of the following 14 financial contagions or combinations could have an enormous impact on the U.S. and world financial markets in 2013 and going forward. To put things in perspective, the United States gross domestic product is $15.09 trillion, and this is in 2011. And the European Union's is $17.5 trillion. So the United States and the European Union that's already in a recession, they have an unemployment rate around 11.9% across the European Union. You have Spain with about 23 to 25% unemployment. You have Ireland, Italy, and some other countries that are having fiscal problems with high double-digit unemployment, and then you have industrious countries like Germany with a 5% unemployment rate, Holland in the 4 to 5% range. So, but when you look at the European Union, they're even larger than us now in gross domestic product, and they're in a recession. So just under half of the world's $69.97 trillion GDP is at a precarious time. And as goes the European Union, and as goes the United States economy, as goes the world. And despite all the money that China has, and the fact that they have $2 trillion worth of our treasuries, and the fact that they have enormous foreign reserves, their economy is weak too, and their economy relies on the United States and the European Union. So the world is in a very precarious stage. We've been kicking the can down the road long enough. We printed money to get out of the problems in 2008, but we took on a tremendous amount more debt. When President Bush left office, the deficit was in the 12 trillion range, or just it was about 11.9. And now we're at 16.3 trillion, increasing at over 100 billion a month. These are astronomical numbers. So, volatile time. Six, this is very interesting. A friend, Eric Hadik, he's an expert on cycles, biblical cycles and cycles. He determined that we've had six 40-year financial corrections since 1773. So in other words, every 40 years, at the end of 40, we have a major financial correction. The end of the sixth 40th year period is 2013. And in that sixth 40-year period, we've had moving the dollar. Okay, we had the Federal Reserve established. We saw the dollar. We used to have the dollar backed by gold. That was pulled away. In 1973, 40 years ago, we had the major economic collapse due to the price of oil. And here we are at 2013 with the Federal Reserve issue, with the fact America's off the gold standard, the fact that we have 16.5 $3 trillion in deficit, and the fact that we have a volatile oil market because of the volatility of the situations that are taking place right now in the Middle East. Fiscal cliff. The fiscal cliff taxes could be high as $536 billion. There's a debate right now, is Obama going to allow the fiscal, all these tax cuts to expire, the death tax to come back, and also the $100 billion kick-in of expenditure elimination. The main concern about the fiscal cliff allowing these tax hikes would increase American taxpayers' taxes of $536 billion in 2013. And $100 billion worth of spending cuts would knock off the budget. You know, people know you need to spend money to make money. When you make money, then you pay more taxes. But this fiscal cliff debate over the last couple of years, more and more Republicans are wondering if Obama's even serious about doing anything with the fiscal cliff and allowing these tax breaks to expire to the point that we, the American taxpayer, would be responsible for $536 billion in additional taxes. Last week, one of the Council of Economic Advisors said that's important that these tax cuts are allowed to continue because $200 billion, just $200 billion alone would affect the gross domestic product 1.3%. So we're expecting the economy to grow 3% next year, and 1.3%, if this $200 billion figure, we would lose almost half our economic growth next year if just $200 billion worth of tax cuts were allowed to be in place. It's a complicated issue. I'm sorry I could have been a little bit more precise, but the bottom line is these tax benefits that leave this money in American taxpayers' pockets are incredibly important to this economy. The increasing chance of a serious U.S. recession due to stagnant growth and the lack of corporate and consumer confidence. Consumer confidence is very significant. 70% of our gross domestic product is consumer spending. If consumers aren't spending money, then earnings are weak, stock prices are weak, and companies have to lay off people. Half of the nation's 40 biggest publicly traded corporate spenders announced just a couple days after the election that they were going to curtail capital expenditures this year or next, the remaining part of 2012 or next. The Federal Reserve has continued the purchase of U.S. federal debt. They purchased 61% of our treasuries last year because we don't have enough foreign buyers and we don't have enough corporate buyers in America. So the Federal Reserve is buying the debt that they helped produce in the first place. And then Obama's threat on increased tax rates on those making over $250,000, the millionaire billionaire tax, as it's been called. The cost of Obamacare is already having an economic impact through employee layoffs, job freezes, and the reclassification of employees to independent contractors to pass on the additional health care costs. Bad timing for Obamacare. We all know it. We talked about it last year at this conference. It's bad timing with a weak economy. And then according to the Economic Policy Institute, 42.2 million Americans are on food stamps. That's a 12 million increase since Obama took office in 2009. And then a couple final ones here. Concerns over another coordinated effort by Chinese, Russian, and Middle Eastern oil funds to collapse the U.S. financial markets. Kevin Freeman, who lives here in the Dallas-Fort Worth area now, who wrote the book Secret Weapon, has a very strong financial background. I met recently at a conference in Washington, says that Chinese, Russian, and Middle Eastern sovereign oil funds coordinated an attack on the market with vast sums of money in September and help lead into our Wall Street collapse. And he has all the details, and he says they're poised to do this one more time. And then we have $600 trillion in notional value of financial derivatives that are at risk, and that's 9 of our 10 largest banks are the biggest players in this casino, which brought us the subprime fiasco situation of 2008. We had to have a $700 billion TARP program of bailing out Wall Street and investment banks. When I say we had to, that's what they ended up doing. And also major banks, $700 billion. U.S. taxpayers, the casino gamblers of Wall Street, we bailed out. And then in early 2009, we had a $787 billion federal economic stimulus package that has not been effective in terms of stimulating our economy. Our economy is still at 8% unemployment. We're probably between 12 and 14% in actual because people took less job based on their skills or they just quit looking. So the European recession is worsening with an outside possibility of some collapses because there's five countries there that are in bad shape with their debt, like Greece, Ireland, Italy, Portugal, and I think Iceland was the other. And Greece was, I mentioned that, but yeah, Greece for sure. And then the potential oil disruption of the Persian Gulf. And if Arab oil interests force the U.S. and the EU to pressure Israel to comply. This is a lot of stuff. I wanted to give you an idea that we're watching it very, very closely. This is something you need to talk to your financial advisor. I mean, this is a time to be conservative. I think you already know that. But there are a lot of dots in play right now. I've been following this for 16 years. I've never seen so many dots in the financial world as well that are all very, very serious. No need to fear. No need to fear, but it's a good time to plan, and a lot of you have been planning for 10 or 15 or 20 years. But nonetheless, that's where we stand. Okay, then my final message here is Israel and the Middle East. We are watching what's taking place in Israel and the Middle East since the Arab Spring. It's breathtaking to see what's taking place. Ezekiel 38 and 39, the countries mentioned in Psalm 83. Isaiah 17:1, talking about the elimination of Damascus, Syria. What's taking place with Iran right now? This is an amazing time. But to keep this in perspective is 100 million church attendees in the U.S. and 1 billion worldwide do not understand the biblical significance of the nation of Israel. 67% of the American church is from church attendees are from replacement theology churches. That totals 100 million American churchgoers that don't understand the biblical significance of what's taking place in Israel and the Middle East right now. And they, as Paul so well explained, are blaming us for the reason there isn't peace in the Middle East. Incredible deception. I mean, guys like Stephen Seitzer and all these other guys Paul shared with us, they're looking at us as the reason that Israel hasn't cooperated. They're looking at us as if we're the problem. But I say to these people, look, if the World Council churches, the National Council churches, and the Vatican had read the scriptures and understood the scriptures, they would not be standing on the side of the EU or the United Nations or Russia. They're on the wrong side of this equation. They need to be on the side of the scriptures from Genesis to Revelation and with the nation of Israel. And how about this? The most important time in biblical history with the least amount of interest in the church. I marvel at that as well. The most important time in biblical history, in other words, the time right before Christ returned to Jerusalem, and the least amount of interest in the church, and the greatest amount of confusion. And I document that in Is America Under Judgment? It is unbelievable, the condition of the church. And you've heard a lot of that in the last couple days. This was a very significant decision, and this was last week. The UN General Assembly voted 138-9 with 41 abstentions in favor of a non-member status for Palestine. The UN General Assembly does not have the clout. The clout is the UN Security Council. But this is significant, and it's a four-page document they voted on. I'm going to write about it in the news report this weekend, but the language in that report is going to set precedents for future discussions about the possibility of a Palestinian state. That's the danger, the language in the document. The UN Security Council has 5 permanent members and 10 non-permanent that rotate. The 5 permanent are Russia, China, France, the United Kingdom, and the United States. And for a UN resolution to be passed, it has to be unanimous among the 5 permanent members. And that's difficult. But right now, those permanent members, Russia, China, and France, and the United Kingdom's being, they talked about, they abstained in this, but for the most part, they favor a Palestinian state and the United States. So technically, we have 4 of the 5 members of the UN Security Council that favor a Palestinian state. But the language it was used is critical. But then this is a powerful statement by Netanyahu, said the next day, there is no power in the world that can disconnect the Jewish people from the land of Israel. Powerful statement, and absolutely right. The UN resolution will not change anything on the ground, he said. It won't bring a Palestinian state closer to existence, but push it further away. He said, Israel's hand is extended in peace, but there will not be a Palestinian state without the recognition of Israel as a Jewish state. The Palestinians won't do that. A Palestinian state will never be established without the declaration on ending the conflict and the establishment of security arrangements to protect the state of Israel and its citizens. In other words, a demilitarized Palestinian state. They won't agree to that either. And especially after this recent conflict with Gaza and the one in 2006 with Hezbollah and the one in 2008 with Hamas, we know these rockets are getting a little bit further distance now. And these missiles are, you know, they're some pretty serious weaponry being moved into Hezbollah on the Israeli border. But I also know a general that told a good friend of mine in Israel that the next time we go to war with Hezbollah, parts of southern Lebanon will not be inhabitable for 10 years because Israel is not going to put their citizens anywhere in the country, Jews and Arabs, at risk. And this next conflict that's coming is going to be very serious. But we all know, as Zechariah 12:3 says, and in that day, God will make Jerusalem a burdensome stone for all people, and all that burden themselves with it shall be cut in pieces, though all the people of the earth be gathered together against it. Abbas stated on Sunday that he looks forward to the day that he plants a Palestinian flag in Jerusalem. And we know that virtually every nation of the world, except for maybe those ones in the South Pacific, Micronesia and Canada, do not favor the dividing of the city of Jerusalem. But for the most part, and as Randall shared tonight, the White House, the State Department, and the Commerce Department, I know for a fact, are leaving Israel off when it's mentioned Jerusalem. Even when Biden went to Israel in 2010, when he was there the first time, it said Jerusalem, Israel. But a few months later, they took Israel off the White House website. And God says, and it shall come to pass in that day that I will seek to destroy all the nations that come against Jerusalem, and he will gather all nations and bring them down to the Valley of Jehoshaphat, the Valley of Judgment. I'm going to go through this quickly as I end. These are the 9 men who will impact Israel and the Middle East in 2013. Obama, Netanyahu, Khamenei, Abdullah, Erdogan, Morsi, the Emir of Qatar, Assad, and Putin. Moderately, Abbas and Abdullah of Jordan, and 5 extremists. I'll go through these real quick. We all remember this photo. Very significant. A couple months later, he received the King Abdulaziz Award from the Saudi King. Within months of office, he also received a Nobel Peace Prize before he'd done anything. It took President Bush 8 years to get that award in Riyadh. I was on that trip. When we were in Riyadh, he received the King Abdulaziz Award in January of 2008. Obama receives it from the king prior to his trip to Cairo, Egypt on June 4, 2009 to speak to the Muslim world about how great Islam was. He's an apologist in chief. our president of the United States, is an apologist of in chief for Islam. Benjamin Netanyahu's great visual. This is classic. Israel has a serious problem, and it's called Iran, and this is the red line. Khomeini and the cartoon figure to the right, who's been marginalized very much so. He's just a puppet right now. He's just moving, and he's got a few more months in office, and he'll be replaced. But Khomeini is a dangerous man, and he had a non-alignment meeting recently in Tehran. The United Nations Secretary General went there despite Israel's request and the United States' request, don't go, but he went. King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia had an 11-hour surgery last week at 88. His health is failing quickly, and there's probably a good probability that this might be his last year of living, 2012 or 2013. This could be very significant. We still receive a tremendous amount of oil from Saudi Arabia. Turkish Prime Minister Erdogan, his best friend, or President Obama's best friend in the Middle East, is Erdogan from Turkey. And you know the statement that he's made about Israel over the last couple of years, and he is playing to the Arab street. He wants to be one of the top leaders, if not the top leader in the Middle East. Not very popular by the Arab leaders throughout the Middle East, but he's very popular on the street, as Nasser was in Egypt. And Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi, I was at Bill Clinton's Global Initiative event at the end of September in New York City. Morsi was the last speaker. He spoke for an hour. Then he took questions and answers with Clinton for 45 minutes. This guy said everything you would want him to say. And so effectively, he's the political figure for Muslim Brotherhood. And look what he's trying to do. He's fired the military. He's fired the top leaders of the military. He's fired the top leaders of the intelligence community. He had to leave. He had to leave the palace tonight because he had 100,000 protesters in Cairo over his attempt to do what he is with the courts and to force this constitution on the Egyptian people. Very significant, but he said all the things. Bill Clinton and all these leaders who were at the Clinton Global Initiative were eating it up. His ceasefire role was Hillary Clinton said, look, we give you $1.5 billion, you better get this done. We used United States money pressure on Morsi to get the ceasefire done, and look what he did 48 hours later, then 72 hours, and a week later. Look what he's done since then. And the Emir of Qatar, this is a very important guy. He has offered the Palestinians $400 million. He was in Gaza a week before this big outbreak. And what's important about the Emir of Qatar, he wants to be another major Middle Eastern player, and he has a tremendous amount of money, and he owns Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera is an incredible propaganda vehicle for the Arabs throughout the Middle East. And then the Syrian President Assad, look, he's been able to hold into office for almost 20-some months. It's amazing because Russia and China have held him up, have propped him up because they are friends of Iran and they want to see Assad stay in place because they also think it's important to Iran's role in the Middle East. And Assad, in the last 24 to 48 hours, they've been moving some chemical weapons around, and there's some concern about and the White House is even threatened if they do something, maybe something will happen. Maybe the United States will respond, but we don't know what's going to happen at this point. But we're very concerned about the chemical weapons that they have and the fact that they have the most advanced chemical weapons in the world, and they have chemical weapons in their Scud missiles that they got from North Korea that can hit any part of Israel. They literally can hit any part of Israel. And then we can look at Isaiah 17:1 about Damascus. Putin is a player, and he's becoming a bigger player, and the Russian's oil company, Gazprom, has cut a joint venture deal with the Israeli oil companies that have found that vast amount of natural gas off their shore because they already have the infrastructure in Europe, and unfortunately, the Netanyahu government in Russia has done a lot of things in order to do joint venture business relationships with Russia in an attempt to move them away from Arab interests. But the fact is, Israel's incredible amount of natural gas is now part of a partnership, a market distribution partnership with Russia. And I can go on and on about that, but nonetheless, Putin's going to be a very significant player here. And then Abbas. I mean, he cannot even get a peace deal done. Even if he agreed to a deal, he can't get it done because he only represents a small percentage of the Palestinian community. 74 of 132 seats in the Palestinian parliament is Hamas. But nonetheless, he is being used for political purposes. King Abdullah from Jordan has a Muslim Brotherhood problem. Some people think that Jordan will fall before Syria will fall. The Muslim Brotherhood, just a quick note here, the Muslim Brotherhood is about 75-80, Sunnis are about 75-80% of Syria. About 15% Alawite, which are kind of quasi-Shiite that are being bankrolled by Iran, but are in key positions of commerce and security in the military, so they've been able to keep Assad in office. But nonetheless, King Abdullah is very concerned. And also Israel's very concerned because in the past they had relatively quiet borders. But right now they don't, with Egypt, Syria, and Jordan, and then Hezbollah there in Lebanon. And then just these last couple, then the Muslim Brotherhood leader, Mohammed Badi, he's the guy 24 hours after Israel cut a ceasefire deal with Hamas, said this was a mistake. This guy and the Muslim Brotherhood leaders are looking at Jerusalem as a future capital of Egypt. We've heard their rants at some of their prayer events. This guy we're watching very closely because these terror groups, they have the political figure like Morsi and the religious figure. Watch what the religious figures say, and that'll give you a good idea what's really taking place. And these are the four terrorist leaders. You've got the two Hamas guys at the top. You've got Nasrallah there with Hezbollah. And then you've got the Islamic Jihad leader, Shala. These are all key players. So these are the guys we're watching very, very closely moving into the new year. And I can tell you what you've heard this last couple of days and what you've heard this evening is we literally are watching the scriptures play out right before our eyes. And we're blessed. Because we understand what's going on. And we need to continue to try to share this with others because there is still a lot of interest in prophecy. But a lot of people have never even had the opportunity to hear about it in their church or in the synagogues. I have Jewish friends that work at the White House as correspondents that I'm educating them right now on what the scriptures say. I have 5 Middle Eastern correspondent friends that I'm telling them about Armageddon, about Jerusalem, and about the final wars that Israel will fight. So we all have opportunities there, and we're just blessed to understand. We are so blessed to fully understand the biblical significance of the times that we're living in. Thank you. Thank you.